relented and agreed to keep Aaron on the team, but it came with a condition. Aaron said Meyer told him, "We'll let you stay on the team for your junior year, but that's it. You're going to have to turn pro after that." Aaron told me he literally didn't have a choice to come back for his senior season. He knew his junior season would be his last at Florida. Meyer had done all he could. He had counseled Aaron about losing his father, introduced him to the Bible, turned him into a star player, but he also knew chances were great Aaron would not be around for his senior year because of either poor grades or failing more drug tests. Seldom does a coach tell a talent like Aaron he can't come back for his senior year, but Meyer couldn't keep Aaron out of Bristol or the Bristol out of Aaron. "Unfortunately, you can't lock them up and keep them away from their homeboys," Meyer once said. When I asked Aaron about this, he had no idea what I was talking about. "Man, I barely ever went home. I didn't have the money. The trouble I got into really wasn't much trouble. It was slacking off on the rules. I was a kid in a candy store, and there was no one other than the coaches around to tell us we couldn't do what we wanted to do." This made perfect sense. Urban Meyer's program was rife with players getting arrested and getting into all kinds of trouble. One year during Aaron's tenure at the University of Florida, the team not only set records on the football field for wins, they also set the record for most arrests of players in the program. Ironically, for all the talk I have heard and read about Aaron being such a bad boy in college, he was one of the few players who never got arrested. Aaron went on to have a monster season his junior year, catching 68 passes for 850 yards and 5 touchdowns. The 2009 Gators finished the regular season unbeaten at 12-0, but lost to eventual national champion Alabama 32-13 in the Southeastern Conference Championship game, ruining their chances to be back-to-back national champions. They would end up 13-1 and ranked number 3 in the national polls. Aaron was named first-team All-American and won the John Mackey Award for being the best tight end in college football. He achieved all that while smoking weed regularly. He justified his drug use to me by saying weed made his head clear. He would get into a zone where he felt he was faster and operated on another level. "Every time I was on the field, I was high on weed," he told me. "I could not play without weed." The medical benefits of marijuana are becoming more acceptable now, and there are even calls from some within the NFL to legalize the drug as a form of therapy. In August of 2017, the NFL sent a letter to the NFL Players Association indicating it was willing to work with the association to study the potential use of marijuana for pain management. The letter indicated areas for potential research, including pain management for acute and chronic conditions. Aaron was way ahead of his time when he claimed smoking weed helped him heal faster from his injuries and even prevented injuries. "Before, when I played high school ball, it would take a few days to recover from the bruises and everything," he said. "But when I started smoking weed, I never really had those issues." What many people don't realize is just how prevalent marijuana is in football, and not just with the pros. I have represented multiple college football players over the years and gone to visit them several times at various dorms. Each and every one of these dorms smelled like a marijuana dispensary, and the coaches and organizations knew it. You can't walk within 20 feet of a team dorm or hotel room and not smell the weed. It is a part of the game, and the players all swear by its medical benefits. But in order for football to keep its squeaky clean image for sponsors and league officials, they act like it doesn't exist, and have blocked marijuana from the list of approved substances players can take. Teams continue to conduct ridiculous piss tests to detect drug use and act on the results at their own discretion. Good players are given multiple chances. If a player has no value to the team, a positive test can be used as an excuse to dump him and release his scholarship, all while maintaining the public position that the player was dismissed for violating team rules. Whenever you see a player getting dismissed from a major college program for violation of team rules, I will bet the house the player was no longer needed on the team and he got popped on a piss test. There were a couple of times in college when Aaron said he tried not to smoke so he wouldn't get popped and disciplined by Meyer, but he just didn't heal as fast. The way he explained himself was, "I did it because I wanted to do it, but the healing just kind of reinforced it for me." He never trashed Urban Meyer to me. Aaron accepted responsibility for what went on at Florida. "I was fucking up," he said. "I could have been more mature, and I wasn't." Aaron left Florida after the Sugar Bowl in January 2010 to prepare for the draft. He spent 2.5 months in California getting ready for the NFL Scouting Combine, held that February in Indianapolis, and then the Pro Day at Florida that followed a few weeks later. Aaron worked out at the training facility owned by his agent, Brian Murphy. As he did with all of his clients, Murphy oversaw Aaron's preparation program, which included strength training and classroom instruction on how to handle the interview process. Bradley became Aaron's primary weed dealer whenever he was back in Bristol for a visit. Sometimes Aaron paid him for the weed, sometimes he didn't. Once Aaron got drafted by the Patriots and he moved to an apartment in Plainview, Massachusetts, the two started to hang out with each other more. Bradley visited Aaron's home up to 3 to 4 times a week. They would play video games, smoke weed, drink, and frequent nightclubs in Boston, Rhode Island, or Springfield, Massachusetts. Bradley said he and Aaron became best friends and would text each other every day. "You want a step?" one or the other would ask, and off they would go. Most of the time when they went out, it was just the two of them. Aaron's other friends didn't like Bradley and didn't trust him. They thought Bradley was just using Aaron for his money and celebrity. They heard about the way he ran his drug business and saw him as bad news. However, Bradley served two purposes. In addition to supplying Aaron with weed, Bradley was also his muscle. Before Aaron signed his $40 million contract in August 2012, he was making the league minimum. While he may have been the best college tight end in the country, his immaturity and discipline issues in college caused his draft stock to fall, and he wasn't selected until the fourth round. He was the 113th overall player selected, far lower than his real talents warranted. If he was going to make money in the NFL, he was going to have to earn it. Until then, his $320,000 base salary as a rookie, $200,000 signing bonus, and an additional $76,000 for making the roster would have to do. While that amount is more than most Americans make in a year, take into consideration the cuts taken by his agent, financial planner, and trainers. The advances given to him to prepare for the NFL Combine also had to be repaid, leaving a struggling college dropout with just enough to party away in a few months. Unfortunately for the players, they become instant celebrities in the cities they play in, and if they act their age, they are going to go out and act like big spenders. Aaron, like most players, could not afford security, so he did what most players do. They hang out with their boys from the neighborhood. And many times these boys are thugs and gangsters. People do not usually mess with them, and no one was going to mess with Sherrod. Many professional athletes also dabble in the drug trade. While Aaron did not sell drugs himself, he did invest in them. There is even a name for it, floating. The sad fact of life is that there are very few ways to get out of the ghetto. Sports is one of them. Rapping is another. A few people break out through education and other unique opportunities. Many turn to the illegal drug trade. It's a quick business, and usually people already know the customers. All aspiring dealers generally need to make it big in the drug trade is for someone to float them some money to buy the drugs. They then mark up the drugs so high that not only do they make a living, but there's enough left over for the floater to make serious money. The return is higher than anything they'd make on Wall Street. The athletes who get involved with floating are usually players of color who come from predominantly minority-based neighborhoods and have $20,000 to $50,000 to spare. All they have to do is hand the money to someone they trust and wait for the return. There is little to no risk because many times no mention of drugs is made. The floater makes the loan knowing only that they will be getting a hefty return. Aaron was no exception. When Aaron joined the Patriots in 2010 out of the University of Florida, he was given the number 85, but in 2011, a flamboyant wide receiver formerly known as Chad Johnson joined the Patriots after 10 seasons with the Cincinnati Bengals. By that time, Johnson had legally changed his name to Ocho Cinco, Spanish for the number 85. Aaron figured Ocho Cinco might want to wear number 85 with the Patriots, so he approached Ocho Cinco and offered to sell him the number for $75,000. Mr. Cinco balked at the price and countered with $50,000. Aaron accepted, gave him the number, and went back to the number 81 he had used in college. Aaron took the money and floated it to his cousin's husband, T.L. Singleton, who gave Aaron back $120,000. I asked Aaron why he would risk everything for what would be comparatively little, and his response made more sense than I expected. He said, "I had no idea what he was going to do with it. Of course I suspected, but we never spoke about it. All I had to do was give Aaron a look, and he folded like a lawn chair and said, 'Okay.' I knew what he was going to do with it, but it is not something we ever spoke of. He just paid me back. I was broke as fuck. I can't tell you how many times I've gone out to eat or drink with teammates and didn't have the money to cover the bill. He was talking about the baller life and the peer pressure of keeping up in order to be considered a good teammate. I have asked Aaron and other players about floating and was told by multiple sources that everybody has either done it or doesn't. Chances are, if you come from the hood and you come into some money, you have floated one time or another. I often wonder how many times the NFL has turned a blind eye to floating with all the resources they spend investigating players for the draft. Does it ever consider where players' money goes? The NFL has to know floating exists given the sheer number of players doing it. I'm reminded of the Humphrey Bogart movie Casablanca when police captain Louis Renault claims to have just found out there is illegal gambling going on at Rick's. He says, "I am shocked, shocked to find that there is gambling going on in here." Just as an employee walks up to him and says, "Your winnings, Captain." He quickly says, "Oh, thank you very much," and tucks the money away as he shuts down the bar for gambling. Many people thought of Bradley as a hanger-on and that Aaron led and Bradley followed. The dynamic was really more the other way around. Aaron was usually broke. Bradley, who was several years older, was not. In fact, Aaron would often borrow money from Bradley. While most people from the neighborhood were hitting Aaron up for money because he was a big-time NFL superstar, Bradley was not. He didn't need Aaron's money, and he also protected Aaron from people who would try to bother him. When football players go out at night, they run into all different types of people. Yes, there are the adoring fans and girls, but there are also those who want to bother you, ask for pictures, talk your ear off, not allow you to have a good time. Then there are thugs who want to make a name for themselves, and kicking an NFL football player's ass or snatching his chain goes a long way in earning them street credit. Being with Bradley protected Aaron from all of that. The second anyone stepped out of line, Sherrod the Shooter was there. Most people knew who he was, and those who didn't learned the hard way. Bradley's girlfriend Kelly Kay didn't like the relationship with Aaron. She lived with Bradley in a state-supported housing complex along Lake Avenue, and Kay didn't like how much time Bradley was spending with Aaron, nor their frequent visits to nightclubs. She might turn a blind eye to Bradley's drug business, but Kay knew Aaron was a celebrity athlete, and figured wherever they went, there would be women chasing the two of them. It wasn't long before she kicked Bradley out of the apartment and ended the relationship. Bradley, a single man now, was able to spend more time with Aaron. Aaron even provided Bradley with tickets to Patriots games during the 2011 season and Super Bowl 46 in Indianapolis, where New England lost to the New York Giants 21-17 at Lucas Oil Stadium. The loss was a bitter defeat for Aaron, who had always dreamed of being a Super Bowl champion, and going out in Boston meant being reminded by fans they had lost the biggest game of the season. Bradley viewed himself as a bodyguard and confidant of Aaron, but the weed was always the bond. Bradley continued to supply Aaron with marijuana, while Aaron supplied Bradley with access to the life of a celebrity. When they went to nightclubs, they didn't have to stand in line. They didn't have to pay a cover charge, and often didn't pay for their drinks. Aaron was a patriot, a member of one of the most famous franchises in professional sports. Bradley, with his size, looked like he could be a professional athlete, too. Even though he was in his early 30s, if he was with Aaron, Bradley convinced most clubgoers that he must be a baller, too. Bradley liked that. The beautiful friendship ended in West Palm Beach when Bradley felt betrayed by Aaron for setting him up with those Florida niggas. Back in Bristol, with only one eye to show for it, Bradley was going to get his revenge in the best way possible, through blood and money. Bradley began texting Aaron incessantly, constantly accusing Aaron of shooting him and demanding money as compensation. Aaron immediately called Brian Murphy and told him about the situation. Murphy hired civil lawyers for Aaron and ordered Aaron not to reply to any of Bradley's texts. Even so, Aaron would occasionally respond and deny he shot Bradley. In between demands for money, there were threats to Aaron's life. Bradley knew where Aaron lived. He also knew where everyone related to Aaron lived in Bristol. This was hands down the most frightening time of Aaron's life. To have someone like Sherrod the Shooter haunting you, calling you, threatening to kill you, can unnerve even a man as street smart and physically imposing as Aaron Hernandez. Aaron tried to protect himself. Soon after moving into the mansion in the winter of 2012 with Shayana and Aviel, who was born that November, Aaron immediately installed a complete surveillance system with cameras everywhere, inside and out. He wanted to make sure Shayana and the baby were safe. He also began arming himself because many of Bradley's texts bragged about his weaponry. Aaron struggled with how to tell, and what to tell, aside from his agent Murphy, who could he trust? At what point would he have to tell Coach Belichick? I knew once I told Coach, it would be over. My whole life would be over. So I put it off as much as I could, Aaron told me. Aside from arming himself, Aaron needed new muscle, someone he could trust. So again, he reached out to his boys from the hood. Ernest Bo Wallace, a close friend of the family, and Carlos Ortiz. Both had extensive criminal backgrounds, and neither was afraid of Bradley. Both would now watch Aaron's back for a not-so-small fee. Bradley's life was also unraveling, if not just as fast, then maybe faster. After returning to Bristol from West Palm Beach, his patience grew thinner and began to manifest itself through violence. In April 2013, fresh off surgery, Bradley got arrested for domestic violence against his girlfriend, Kelly Kay. He continued hounding Aaron, demanding money, but was getting nowhere. Aaron's civil lawyers were agreeable to settling the dispute, but for nowhere near the $1.5 million Bradley was demanding. After unsuccessfully threatening to kill him, rat him out to the Patriots, contact the media, Bradley finally made good on at least one of his threats when he filed his civil lawsuit against Aaron on June 1, 2013. But before it could make any serious headlines, Aaron was arrested for the murder of Odin Lloyd on June 26, 2013. The arrest was not good for Bradley's lawsuit, as all of Aaron's resources would now go toward his defense, and any civil matters would take a back seat to his criminal trial. The shocking news of the Odin Lloyd murder accusations clearly overshadowed any news about Bradley losing an eye. Things were going downhill for Bradley fast. The prosecutors in both Boston and Bristol County, Massachusetts, wanted to speak to Bradley, but how would this affect his lawsuit? He did not want Aaron to go down until he got his pound of flesh first. So initially, he refused to cooperate. Then, after he failed to appear at a grand jury proceeding in Boston, prosecutors had had enough. They issued a warrant for Bradley's arrest and found him in the one place he was not supposed to be, Kelly Kay's house. There was a domestic violence order requiring him to have no contact with her. Bradley quickly learned that Boston prosecutors and the Bristol police were not playing around. The police kicked down Kelly Kay's door to arrest him. After throwing him in jail for failure to appear on a grand jury subpoena and violating the protective order, the judge slapped him with an unprecedented $250,000 bond, which Bradley could not post. The walls were closing in on him. Aaron was already in jail for Odin Lloyd, and Boston detectives were closing in on him and Aaron for the double murder of Abreu and Furtado. Bradley, ever the criminal genius, knew nobody cared about him. They all wanted the NFL superstar. With his chances of recovering money on a lawsuit dwindling, it was time to cut his losses, save himself, and offer up the only currency he had left. Aaron Hernandez. Chapter 11. Trapping a Rat. Informants are common in our criminal justice system. They assist law enforcement in breaking open investigations by providing information police might not otherwise come to know. Usually, informants are criminals who try to exchange information for leniency, a kind of you-scratch-my-back-and-I'll-scratch-yours arrangement. But criminals are not always the sharpest tool in the shed. They make impulsive decisions that adversely affect their future. They are, after all, criminals. Sometimes the informants make good deals. Sometimes they make terrible deals. I guess the success of the deal depends on whether the quid quo pro is even. Does the prosecutor have a stronger case against the rat or the target? What information is the informant offering? Does it make the prosecution's case? Can any of the information that would not have normally been obtained through an investigation be independently verified? These are all variables in the art of the deal for rats. I have never been on either side of the table during this kind of negotiation, but I have had many cases involving jailhouse snitches and rats, and have had plenty of opportunities to cross-examine them. Although after his acquittal, Aaron gave me permission to tell his story, he did so with the clear understanding that I would not snitch or inform on anyone. This was not only for my protection, but also because I am fundamentally opposed to the way government uses confidential informants or snitches. My firm handles a limited number of drug cases, but when we do, we have a strict policy of not representing anyone interested in snitching as part of a plea deal. There are multiple reasons for this. First, I cannot ask anyone to ever trust me if I assist a snitch in setting someone up, taking them away from their families, and destroying their freedom just because I have a client who did the crime but doesn't want to do the time. Second, I do not approve of the way law enforcement uses people they have arrested to entrap and many times set up other people who were not predisposed to commit a crime just so they can make more arrests. Third, working with snitches is extremely bad for business, as many of those ultimately arrested or set up by the informant want to hire us to represent them, and that would create a conflict of interest for me. A lawyer who represents a snitch never knows who their client is setting up. If the entrapped individual then hires the same lawyer, the lawyer would never know it was his or her former client that set up their new client. Making backroom deals is a dangerous game I refuse to play. It means living in a world of deception. I don't claim any moral high road here. Wheeling and dealing with people's lives just doesn't feel right to me. It goes against my nature. The terms rat and snitch are used interchangeably, but they are very different. Jailhouse snitches, or bitches as they are known, are inmates who call up police and tell them they have befriended a prisoner who couldn't help but pour their heart out to this stranger, who for obvious reasons cannot be trusted. We did not have a jailhouse snitch in Aaron's case, but in high-profile cases, you have to expect them at any minute. Rats are individuals who commit crimes and do not want to do the time, so they rat out their friends. This may all seem obvious, but what isn't so obvious is the way they are treated and the reliability and accuracy of their information. I understand when prosecutors use rats to make their case, but I am a firm believer that they need to make sure they can independently verify the information they are being given. To do this, they really need to do their homework on who they are dealing with to ensure they are not putting a violent criminal on the streets while letting the least culpable person in the crime go to prison. The opportunity for criminals to get away with murder triggers a race to the prosecutor's office to see who flips first and gets their deal. This is a pathetic way of dispensing justice. I know for a fact that prosecutors all across America are betraying the public trust by allowing deals to be made without exercising proper discretion. Such was the case with Alexander Bradley. Everybody seemed to be getting immunity in Aaron's case. The one who benefited the most was Bradley. Bradley was no fool. He had been dealing drugs for about 10 years when he finally felt the walls closing in on him. He was looking at a potential double murder charge in Boston, for which he was exposed to a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Until now, he had moved in many circles in the underworld and managed to become a major drug trafficker in Connecticut, without spending any real time behind bars. His priors all consisted of minor charges for possession, traffic offenses, and a domestic violence case involving Kelly Kay. This is important to note because someone in this position usually avoids prison in one of two ways, by being smart about his or her dealings and avoiding detection, or by becoming a confidential informant. I never had any evidence that told me Bradley was a confidential informant. The fact that he never did any real time was certainly a red flag. So was the shooting in Bristol with Jamar, after which the cops just called him on the phone to ask if he was involved. That is the way informants are protected. While they can be useful to law enforcement, they aren't investigated or prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But again, I never had anything concrete that told me Alexander Bradley was a rat prior to the Aaron Hernandez case. The deal he cut with Boston prosecutors was a good one. Since he was facing life in prison if tried and convicted of the double murder, his immunity agreement was literally the deal of a lifetime. Prosecutors had the option of charging Aaron Hernandez and Alexander Bradley with murder and proceeding on what Massachusetts law calls the joint venture theory. This is a law that allows the prosecution to prove someone guilty of murder even if they don't know who pulled the trigger, as long as there is evidence the person knew about the crime and participated in furthering the crime in some way. So even if Bradley was telling the absolute truth, his actions by running the red light to catch up to the BMW, where Abreu and Furtado were shot, constituted an overt act that furthered and enabled the crime to happen. Under this theory, he could be convicted for first-degree murder and serve life in prison even if Aaron was the one pulling the trigger. This is the same concept of law prosecutors used in Bristol County to convict Aaron of Odin Lloyd's murder. On October 8, 2013, Alexander Bradley sat down with law enforcement, prosecutors, and his own lawyer and proffered, the legal term for telling them what he knew. Under the grant of immunity, he told prosecutors his story in exchange for not being charged for the murders of Daniel de Abreu and Saphiro Furtado. This agreement was committed to writing and became the centerpiece of my cross-examination of Bradley, because I felt it said so much not only about Mr. Bradley and his motives, but also those of the prosecutors for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The agreement starts off with the lead prosecutor laying out his understanding of Bradley's participation or non-participation in the crime by stating, "It is my understanding that Alexander Bradley operated a motor vehicle of which Aaron Hernandez was a passenger. It is my further understanding that Mr. Bradley made certain observations of the fatal shooting at the intersection of Harold Street and Shawmut Avenue in Boston. It is also my understanding that Mr. Bradley did not discharge a firearm at any time on July 16, 2012. Based on these representations, the following sets forth the agreement entered into." As you see, the agreement sets out from the very beginning that in order for Bradley to get this deal, he must say first that he was the driver, second, that he saw the shooting, meaning, of course, Aaron, and third, that he never fired a gun on that night. On its face, the statement may seem harmless, but what this document essentially does is cover the prosecutor's butt and ensure Bradley is going to say Aaron is the shooter. Otherwise, Bradley has no deal. The agreement also repeats the following ad nauseam. In order for Bradley to get this deal, he must provide complete and accurate information. Every paragraph uses wording like complete and truthful, not withhold nor provide false information, and testify truthfully. The grant of immunity basically uses every synonym for the word truth in the English language and explicitly requires Bradley to tell it. Then the document states, if after Mr. Bradley testifies before the grand jury, notice that they are already anticipating a grand jury to indict Aaron without even hearing his full story. The district attorney learns that Mr. Bradley did not give complete and truthful information. The district attorney may declare this agreement null and void. Should the district attorney declare this agreement null and void because of the false information provided by Mr. Bradley, the district attorney may institute a prosecution for perjury. Keep in mind that the first words out of Bradley's mouth about that night were the fake motive of the spilled drink. Was that complete and truthful information? Did it sound complete and truthful to the prosecutor? Only he knows. Then Bradley says Abreu and Sanchez left Cure, crossed the street, and followed him and Aaron to another bar despite video showing conclusively that the Cape Verdean group never left Cure until closing time. Was this complete and accurate information? No. Did it matter to the prosecutor? Apparently not. Alexander Bradley, the drug dealer with blanket immunity, first tells police that he drove the Forerunner out of the Tufts parking garage. Police had to show him that it was Aaron who drove the car out of the garage. Was this complete and accurate? And did it matter to the prosecutors? No. In his first statement to police, Bradley tells them that Aaron's whole body was out the window when he was shooting into the BMW. Then in his second statement, Bradley says it was just his arm. Later at trial, Bradley tries to suggest that Aaron's arm equates to his whole body. The list of inaccuracies and false statements given by Bradley from the very beginning goes on and on. That's before we even get into the craziness of the 104-year-old murder weapon. None of this should have surprised prosecutors who knew what they were dealing with from the moment Bristol Detective Peter Dauphineas said, "That's charade." Bradley could be heard during his calls from jail telling his associates to go around and make collections and not let those niggas think they can get away without paying. Prosecutors knew all this, but ignored the obvious because Bradley was giving them Aaron. Here is the danger in giving criminals immunity. Shortly after making his deal, Bradley was set free. He wasn't given any orders to stop dealing drugs. Police or prosecutors did not go to his home and confiscate any bulletproof vests or guns that he was threatening Aaron with. He wasn't charged for his confession that he had purchased a gun for Aaron. He was set free to do what he pleased, and do it he did. On February 3rd, 2014, less than 4 months after making the deal of a lifetime with Boston prosecutors, Alexander Bradley was in a bar called Vivo Lounge on Meadow Street in Hartford, Connecticut, and got into a dispute with a man named Leslie Randolph. The two had a disagreement over money, and the conflict spilled into the streets. Bradley was shot 3 times during the scuffle, including once in the groin. Video footage shows Bradley threatening people after being shot and going to his car where he retrieved a hidden gun. Sound familiar? Then, in the most reckless disregard for human life, Bradley went back toward the nightclub. As bouncers tried to lock the door, Bradley emptied the magazine of a .40-caliber semi-automatic pistol into the crowd. The video shows Bradley walking with the gun up to the door and trying to open it. When he is not successful, he starts shooting into the crowded nightclub through the window. The video inside of this nightclub, which police successfully recovered, shows men and women tripping and falling over each other as shots ring out throughout the club. I am from Orlando, Florida, where on June 12, 2016, 29-year-old security guard Omar Mateen murdered 49 people and wounded 58 others in a terrorist attack slash hate crime inside Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando. All I could think about was the Pulse shooting as I saw a video of these young people at Vivo falling to the ground or running for their lives. Fortunately for those inside the lounge, Bradley did not kill anyone with his random attack. He returned to his car, tossed his gun, and drove off, only to be stopped later by Hartford police and taken into custody. The message should be clear. Bradley goes to Cure Lounge, two people get shot. He goes to Tootsie's, he gets shot. He goes to Vivo, he gets shot again and shoots up the whole bar. Bradley and bars do not mix. If all of that wasn't enough, police tracked the gun Bradley used in the Vivo shooting to another shooting in Bridgeport, Connecticut, that occurred just a year earlier. Where did this occur? Yep, you guessed it. A bar. Several shots were fired into a bar called Expression Cafe in Bridgeport, striking one male and damaging nearby buildings and cars. I don't know how else to say this other than if you ever see Bradley in a bar, run for your life. Despite Bradley's record and temper, Boston prosecutors kept his deal in place as long as he ratted on Aaron. There was never a threat it would come off the table. Bradley ended up making another deal of a lifetime in the Vivo case. In January 2017, he was sentenced to only 5 years in prison for shooting up the Hartford bar. That's less than 6 months per bullet. Bradley was allowed to plead no contest to criminal possession of a firearm, first-degree reckless endangerment, and third-degree criminal mischief. Boston and Hartford prosecutors claimed they never made any special deals in the Vivo shooting so Bradley would testify against Aaron. I believe Pat Hagen. He is an honest lawyer. But maybe someone else made a call and Pat didn't know about it. Maybe somebody gave a wink and a smile. I have no evidence to support the fact that Boston cops or prosecutors ever gave Bradley a pass on the Vivo shooting. Yet in all my years of experience, I have never seen a case where a crime was actually caught on video, and someone got only 5 years for emptying a gun into a crowded area. Is he that lucky? Does he have a guardian angel? This guy keeps getting shot and lives. I believe what I would later say in my opening statement. Boston prosecutors made a deal with the devil. Chapter 12. Patriot Games. By the time Aaron returned from his photo shoot in Phoenix, he had endured an endless stream of threatening texts from Bradley. "When I get home, you know what time it is," was one of the texts Bradley admitted to a grand jury that he sent Aaron. "I told him I would kill him. I told him I can't wait to see him. I told him I was going to sue him, then kill him." Bradley was losing it. How could things get this crazy? Aaron told me that at this point in his life, he wondered how he could keep his family safe. Bradley's method of retribution was to shoot up the houses of people who owed him money or who he felt had wronged him. What if he tried to shoot up Aaron's house? Aaron thought of someone who might be able to give him some advice, the man he respected most in this world. He was all-knowing, feared, respected, and loved within the football family that was a major part of Aaron's life. The first thing he would do was make sure Shea and Aviel were safe. Then he would call the head coach of the New England Patriots, Bill Belichick. I once asked Aaron why Belichick and the Patriots were so successful. "It's Belichick," he said. "It's his way or no way. You can be the best player on the team, but if you don't do it his way, you're gone." That's the one thing Belichick liked about me, is I did things exactly the way he wanted. I put in my work. I was always in the film room. Tom Brady would know exactly where I was at all times, and I made sure I was where he needed me to be. We all bought into that. About a week after Bradley was shot in West Palm Beach, Aaron contacted Belichick, desperate to schedule a meeting. A plan was made to meet in Belichick's office at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, on Monday, February 18, 2013. Gillette Stadium, which replaced the old Foxborough Stadium, is located 28 miles southwest of Boston and is where the Patriots have played since 2002. The team offices are in the stadium. The practice fields are located outside. Belichick carved out time to meet there with Aaron, but the tight end didn't show up for the appointment. Belichick would tell detectives that Aaron said he missed the meeting because of something that happened in California, though exactly what that meant is unknown. Belichick said Aaron contacted him and asked if the meeting could be rescheduled. This was a busy month for Belichick, who had won 3 Super Bowls since becoming the Patriots' head coach in 2000. He had just missed a chance to be in his sixth Super Bowl appearance, losing the 2012 AFC Championship game to Deontay Thompson's Ravens 28-13. He was already preparing for the 2013 season. Belichick initially asked if they could discuss whatever it was Aaron wanted to talk about over the phone. Aaron insisted on a face-to-face meeting. He was anxious and persuasive. Belichick sensed the urgency in Aaron's request and agreed to a meeting in Indianapolis during the weekend of February 23rd through 24th, 2013. 6 months later, after Aaron had been arrested for the shooting of Odin Lloyd, North Attleboro Police Captain Joseph DiRenzo, Massachusetts State Police Lieutenant Michael King, and Eric J. Benson of the Bristol Homicide Squad visited Belichick's office at Gillette Stadium to find out the details of that February meeting with Aaron. When I read the police report outlining the police interview, I could immediately see that the coach received star treatment. A reporter from the Boston Globe once told me, after he heard we might be calling Belichick to testify, that to New Englanders, calling Belichick was like calling the Pope to testify. That is how much Belichick is revered. The first thing I noticed was that the meeting took place in his office with his attorney Andrew Phelan, a former federal prosecutor, present. That in itself was not a big deal, but the fact that Belichick refused to be recorded made it clear the cops were there as fans, not investigators. Cops don't need anyone's permission to record their conversations in the middle of a murder investigation. They could have done it without his knowledge and consent. They were more concerned with being on good terms with the coach than they were about getting a complete and accurate account of the meeting. What a witness says is so important. A case can turn on a word or two. Like so many critical moments in life, it's not just what a person says, but how they say it that's important. The great Bill Belichick told the homicide detective sitting in his office on August 15th, 2013, that he and Aaron met privately that February in his room at the Westin Hotel in downtown Indianapolis. The police report from the interview with Belichick said Aaron was concerned about the safety of his daughter and his girl. Aaron went on to explain to his coach that he was being threatened by people who might potentially harm his family. Aaron was not concerned about his own safety because he had money, Belichick told the officers, but he was concerned that his recently purchased home did not have a gate or any security. The police report also states that Belichick told the detectives Aaron expressed an interest in relocating. I don't believe Belichick told the whole truth here, or if he did, it wasn't documented. Aaron told me the purpose of the entire meeting was for him to ask Belichick to be traded. He wanted to get as far away from Bradley as possible, even if it meant playing for another team. Aaron told me he told Belichick he did not feel safe and wanted to be traded to a team on the West Coast. Belichick wasn't about to entertain that request. Aaron told me the coach was incensed by the idea and reminded Aaron that the team had made a significant investment in him and had secured long-term deals with him and Rob Gronkowski. The Patriots planned to build their whole offense behind their future Hall of Fame quarterback and two of the best tight ends in football, then rule the football landscape for years to come. Belichick wasn't about to change those plans because of some threatening text messages. Aaron would just have to work out his security concerns. Since cops refused to record Belichick during the meeting, we will never know whether the police report accurately reflects what Belichick said. Of course, Belichick could have just been coy when talking with the cops because of the Odin Lloyd murder. He knew civil lawsuits were pending. Belichick told the detectives he directed Aaron to contact Kevin Anderson, who at the time was the Patriots' director of player development and normally assisted players when they looked for a new residence. According to the report, Belichick also referred Aaron to Chief Operating Officer Mark Briggs to address his security-related concerns. Belichick told detectives he didn't speak with Aaron again until just before the start of off-season workouts on May 1, 2013, when Aaron called to confirm when he needed to be back. By then, Aaron had undergone shoulder surgery in California, where he spent 2 months rehabbing 3,000 miles away from Alexander Bradley and all his threats. Knowing he had to return to New England, Aaron wound up working with Anderson to get a run-down apartment with minimal security while upgrading the security and surveillance of his home in North Attleboro. The Patriots ended their off-season minicamp on June 13, 2013. But 5 days later, the coach learned Aaron was at the team's complex getting treatment for his injuries sustained during the previous season. By this time, Aaron's name had surfaced in connection with the Odin Lloyd shooting, and Belichick wanted to know the truth. The coach told the detectives he summoned Aaron to his office and asked the player point blank if he had any involvement in the homicide. Aaron, according to Belichick, said he was absolutely not involved in the homicide, but explained that he and Lloyd knew each other because the sister of Aaron's girlfriend was dating the victim, and Aaron had rented a vehicle and given the keys to Odin Lloyd. That five-minute conversation would be the last Belichick had with Hernandez, who was arrested while the Patriots head coach was on vacation in Europe. When he returned, the father figure wasted no time in distancing himself from Aaron, who by then had been formally charged with Odin Lloyd's murder. "It's a sad day. It's really a sad day on so many levels," Belichick said while reading a statement just before the start of the Patriots training camp in 2013. "Our thoughts and prayers are with the family of the victim. I extend my sympathy to everyone who has been impacted. A young man lost his life and his family has suffered a tragic loss, and there's no way to understate that. When I was out of the country, I learned about the ongoing criminal investigation that involved one of our players. I and other members of the organization were shocked and disappointed in what we had learned. Having someone in your organization that's involved in a murder investigation is a terrible thing. After consultation with ownership, we acted swiftly and decisively. Robert and his family and I, since I got here in 2000, have always emphasized the need for players and our team and our organization to represent the community the right way, both on and off the field. We've worked very hard together over the past 14 years to put together a winning team that's a pillar in the community, and I agree 100% with that. The comments that Robert's already made on the situation, I stand behind those as well. This case involves an individual who happened to be a New England Patriot. We certainly do not condone unacceptable behavior, and this does not in any way represent the way the New England Patriots want to do things. As the coach of the team, I'm primarily responsible for the people that we bring into the football operation. Our players are generally highly motivated and gifted athletes. They come from very different backgrounds. They've met many challenges along the way and have done things to get here. Sometimes they've made bad or immature decisions. But we try to look at every single situation on a case-by-case basis and try to do what's best for the football team and what's best for the franchise. Most of those decisions have worked out, but some don't. Overall, I'm proud of the hundreds of players that have come through this program, but I'm personally disappointed and hurt in a situation like this. Robert Kraft, CEO of the New England Patriots, also wasted no time rushing to judgment and telling reporters during a press conference that the decision to release Aaron was made before his arrest. "We decided the week prior to Aaron's arrest that if Aaron was arrested in connection with the Lloyd murder case, that we would cut him immediately after," Kraft said. The rationale behind that decision was that if any member of the New England Patriots organization is close enough to a murder investigation to actually get arrested, whether it be for obstruction of justice or the crime itself, it is too close to an unthinkable act for that person to be part of this organization going forward. During that 40-minute press conference, Kraft produced the letter Aaron sent to the Patriots a week before the 2010 NFL draft, discussing his alleged use of marijuana. In the letter addressed to Nick Caserio, the Patriots' director of player personnel, Aaron agreed to be drug tested and have his salary based on the results of those tests. "Dear Mr. Caserio, I am writing in regards to some of the feedback I am receiving from my agents, Florida coaches, and other personnel. These sources have indicated that NFL teams have questions about my alleged use of marijuana. I personally answered these questions during the pre-draft process, but understand that NFL teams want to conduct thorough due diligence before making the significant financial investment inherent in a high draft pick. I have no issue with these questions being asked, but thought that it made the most sense to communicate with you directly regarding this issue, so you would not have to rely upon secondhand information. Any information I volunteer to you about my past will be looked at with great skepticism, as I am trying to get drafted as high as possible by an NFL team. As such, I thought that the best way to answer your questions and your concerns was to make a very simple proposition. If you draft me as a member of the New England Patriots, I will willfully submit to a bi-weekly drug test throughout my rookie season, 8 drug tests during the 2010 regular season. In addition, I will tie any guaranteed portion of my 2010 compensation to these drug tests and reimburse the team a pro rata amount for any failed drug test. My agents have explained that a direct forfeiture provision in my contract along these lines would violate the CBA rules. However, I have instructed them to be creative in finding a contract structure that would work. In the worst-case scenario, I would donate the pro rata portion of any guaranteed money to the team's choice of charities. My point is simple. If I fail a drug test, I do not deserve that portion of the money. I realize that this offer is somewhat unorthodox, but it is also the only way I could think of to let you know how serious I am about reaching my potential in the NFL. My coaches have told you that nobody on our Florida team worked harder than me in terms of workouts, practices, or games. You have your own evaluation as to the type of impact I can have on your offense. The only X factor, according to the reports I have heard, is concerns about my use of recreational drugs. To address that concern, I am literally putting my money where my mouth is and taking the financial risk away from the team and putting it directly on my back where it belongs. In closing, I ask you to trust me when I say you have absolutely nothing to worry about when it comes to me and the use of recreational drugs. I have set very high goals for myself in the NFL and am focused 100% on achieving those goals. So test me all you want during my rookie year. All of the results will be negative while I am having an overwhelming positive impact on the field. Good luck with your preparations for the NFL draft, and feel free to contact me or my agency, athletesfirst.com/David Dunn, with any questions. Sincerely, Aaron Hernandez, University of Florida. Kraft admitted he was initially impressed by the letter, but now the Patriots were trying to erase Aaron from their memory. They even organized a jersey exchange so fans could trade Aaron's jersey for that of another player at the team's pro shop at Gillette Stadium. "We made a mistake," Kraft said. "We're facing it head on. Obviously, it wasn't the correct decision. It's sad. Very sad." It was a disingenuous ending to what had once seemed like the ultimate sports story. Hometown kid makes good with hometown team. Though he had won the John Mackey Award as the best tight end in college football during his junior year at the University of Florida, Aaron's draft stock fell amid rumors of drug use and a propensity to run with the wrong crowd. There was also lingering concern about a bar fight in Gainesville in 2007, when Aaron allegedly punched a bar manager, but was never officially charged in the matter. The 2010 NFL Scouting Combine didn't help Aaron raise his draft stock. Some teams had concerns about the results of his psychological profile that suggested under his weaknesses, he enjoys living on the edge of acceptable behavior and may be prone to partying too much and doing questionable things that could be seen as a problem for him and his team. The 2010 profile was written by Human Resource Tactics, a testing service that profiles elite military units along with 600 college football prospects each year for 20 National Football League teams. Aaron's results were supposed to be confidential, but were published in the Wall Street Journal after his death. What often goes unmentioned, and what the Patriots might have been attracted to most, was the number of strengths listed in Aaron's profile. "Hernandez is a dedicated player who will challenge himself to get better. He knows that hard work has been an essential element of his success to date, and he will continue to give his best in practices. When studying film, and when participating in off-season strength and conditioning programs, his willingness to give his best from start to finish suggests that his performance will improve from year to year. Hernandez sees himself as being a football player above all else. He will place a high priority on football and what it takes to be successful. Compared to other players, Hernandez is very confident of his skills and ability to reach some of his football goals. His confidence will be consistent throughout a game. He will quickly recover from mistakes and bad breaks. Even when things aren't going his way, he will continue to believe in himself. Hernandez's high expectancy for success can be a significant building block in helping him become as good as he can be in the future. All of the mental ability dimensions that we address show good potential for his position. Hernandez's matrices and Wunderlich scores are above the typical minimum for his position. And Sigma scores indicate that he will be able to focus during meetings and practices, and that he can concentrate on executing during games. His excellent mental processing speed will also be a plus for him, in that he will be able to quickly make his reads and properly execute. Hernandez appreciates the contribution coaches have made to his career, and will be willing to listen to their technical critiques and try to follow through on what they want him to do on the field. Hernandez will not be confrontational and divisive in his statements about his teammates and coaches. He will try not to say things that could cause problems in team chemistry. Five tight ends, Jermaine Gresham, first round, 21st overall, Bengals, Rob Gronkowski, second, 42nd, Patriots, Ed Dickerson, third, 70th, Ravens, Tony Moiaki, third, 93rd, Chiefs, and Jimmy Graham, third, 95th, Saints, were selected before the Patriots took Hernandez as 113th pick overall in the fourth round. At the time, it looked like the Patriots had gotten a steal. More to the point, they got a bargain. Not only did they get first-round talent at fourth-round prices, but Aaron had already agreed to certain stipulations that limited the team's financial risk in signing him. Aaron held up his end of the bargain, using his rookie season to become a dedicated team player who stayed out of trouble. It wasn't long into his first training camp that Aaron was noticed by quarterback Tom Brady, who began giving the rookie advice on how to execute certain plays. By the first preseason game, Aaron was catching warm-up passes with veteran receivers like Randy Moss and Wes Welker. It also didn't take long for Aaron to gain attention around the league. In just his second game as pro, Aaron starred against the AFC East rival Jets, catching 6 passes for 101 yards in a 28-14 loss in the Meadowlands. Aaron played in 14 games and started 7 in his rookie season, catching 45 passes for 563 yards and 6 touchdowns. By the end of the 2011 season, he and Rob Gronkowski were being credited for changing the game of football. With Aaron paired with Gronkowski, the Patriots featured the best tight end combination in football, overwhelming defenses with their versatility and talent. Gronk was the most celebrated of the pair. In 2011, he set the single-season record for touchdowns, TDs, by a tight end with 17 receiving TDs, as well as the single-season record for receiving yards by a tight end at 1,327. He was also the first tight end to lead the league in receiving touchdowns. Aaron wasn't bad either. Having changed his number from 85 to 81, he also emerged as a future star, catching 79 passes for 910 yards and 7 TDs. He also ran the ball 5 times for 45 yards as the Patriots began using him as a hybrid running back. The media was captivated by Gronk and his antics, but hardcore followers of football saw something just as special in Aaron. Together, fans were calling them the Boston TE Party. Former Patriots safety Rodney Harrison was interviewed by the Boston Globe after the 2011 season. Obviously, they're both great players, but I think when you look at Aaron Hernandez, he's a kid that they used in a lot of different roles last year. He played wide receiver, he played in the slot, he played tight end, he played some running back, and really showed his versatility, he said. There are just so many different things he can do. The 2011 Patriots would lose the Super Bowl to the Giants in Indianapolis, but Aaron's value to the future of the team became evident when New England signed him to a $41 million contract extension just before the 2012 season. The signing bonus of $12.5 million was the largest ever given to a tight end and the team's second largest extension after signing Gronkowski to a $53 million deal. Aaron publicly thanked the Patriots for the new contract and immediately donated $50,000 to the Myra Kraft Giving Back Fund, a charity named after the deceased wife of Patriots owner Robert Kraft. He didn't need to give me the amount he gave me, and knowing he thinks I deserve that and he trusts me to make the right decisions, it means a lot, Aaron said following the signing. It means he trusts in my character and the person I am, which means a lot. During that time, Aaron told Comcast Sportsnet, "You can't come to the Patriots and act reckless and do your own stuff. That was one of the reasons that I came here. I might have acted the way I wanted to act, but you get changed by Bill Belichick's way, and you get changed by the Patriots' way. And now that I'm a Patriot, I have to start living like it and making the right decisions for them." After signing the contract, everything seemed perfect in Aaron's life. He was happy with his team, including his relationship with Brady, who, "I love to death and always will." When Aaron talked to me in prison about Brady, he told me, "You wouldn't know it, but Brady and I were really close because Brady always wanted to know where I was at all times. He would always tell me, 'Stop hanging with those guys. Get your shit together.' One of the things I regret is not listening to him more." He loved Gronk, too, calling him the best TE ever to walk on a football field. This was when Gronk was coming under intense scrutiny for his late-night shenanigans. I often wonder how different things might have been if the Patriots had listened to Aaron's concerns for his safety and the insanity going on in his life. Instead of showing him any kind of real support, the Patriots used a violation of the morals clause in his contract to cut him once he was arrested, and kept the remaining $3.25 million of his original $12.5 million signing bonus. It was money he could have used for his defense in the Lloyd trial. Things might have been different if they had considered trading him. He certainly would not have been with Odin Lloyd on the evening Lloyd was killed. Without that case, the Boston case would have remained cold. Would Bradley have traveled across the country to execute his revenge? That's probably unlikely. We won't know, because the Patriots didn't want to break up the greatest tight end tandem in football. The Patriots are known as the most thorough organization in the NFL. Why not take a second look when a player travels halfway across the country to meet in the off-season with the head coach and tells him he is concerned about his life and that of his family? I have to imagine that doesn't happen every day. NFL teams spend an obscene amount of money investigating college football players to decide whether they should draft them and spend millions of dollars on them. But this organization did nothing when one of their own came to them with concerns for the safety of his life and that of his family. In a game in which these players risk their lives and personal health with every play, it's nice to know who has your back and who doesn't. Chapter 13. Who Shot Odin Lloyd? When Aaron first learned he was a suspect in the June 2013 murder of Odin Lloyd, he called his agent, Brian Murphy. An athlete's agent is the person who takes them from rags to riches. The athlete trusts his agent with everything. Brian Murphy is one of the better agents I have met. My dealings with him before and after the trial showed me all I needed to know about Murph. He puts his athletes first, so naturally, he named his agency Athletes First. He was one of the few people who never turned his back on Aaron. To this day, he remains concerned about Shayana and Aviel because he knows that is what Aaron would have wanted. I believe Murphy genuinely cared for Aaron, so the first call he made was to his former law firm, Ropes & Gray, and connected Aaron with the best criminal defense lawyer they had, which was Michael Fee. The problem was that most of Fee's experience was in white-collar matters and healthcare compliance cases. He was also a former federal prosecutor, but prosecuting cases and defending them are about as different as murder cases and healthcare compliance cases. I believe that for this reason, he brought in two veteran criminal defense lawyers, Charles W. Rankin and James L. Sultan of Rankin and Sultan. They offered much-needed experience, but the lead lawyer is the one who normally calls the shots. I cannot comment on the team dynamic as I never spoke to Michael Fee, but I did have extensive conversations with Charles and Jamie, as James is known. Both were true gentlemen, and from what I could see, good lawyers as well. They faced challenges and dealt with them the best way they could. As good as they were, I still think I would have tried the case differently. Aaron knew Odin Lloyd through his fiancée, Shayana, because her sister Shania had been dating Odin for approximately a year. Aaron and Odin were not close, but were getting to know each other through a mutual interest in marijuana. Odin supplied Aaron with weed on a number of occasions, though they had only gone out to party together a couple of times. After establishing a relationship, the prosecution did a good job of presenting its timeline during the night of the murder, with a combination of cell tower records, call records, and video surveillance. It was airtight, and it basically excluded any defense other than mere presence. The timeline was as follows. June 16th, 2013, about 9:05 p.m., Hernandez texts Lloyd, "I'm coming to grab that tonight. You gon' be around. I need that, and we could step for a little again." 9:34 p.m., Hernandez texts again, "What up?" Lloyd responds, "Aight," meaning all right, "where?" Hernandez, "IDK, I don't know." "It don't matter, but I'm hit you when I'm that way like last time. If my phone dies, I'm hit you when I charge it, which will be in a lil." 9:35 p.m., Hernandez texts Wallace, "Get your ass up here." 10 p.m., Lloyd texts Hernandez, "Aight, IDK, anything going on?" Hernandez replies, "I'll figure it out, I'll hit you on the way." 10:21 p.m., Hernandez receives the text from Ortiz, the other male associate, saying, "On our way. God bless." Hernandez responds, "Better hurry up, tell Fish," meaning Wallace, "to drive, nigga." 10:23 p.m., Hernandez texts Wallace again, "Hurry your ass up, nigga." June 17th, 12:22 a.m., Lloyd texts Hernandez, "We still on?" About 12:40 a.m., surveillance video shows Shayana with Hernandez as Wallace and Ortiz enter Hernandez's home. Hernandez is also seen holding a gun, which the prosecution later put on evidence was possibly a Glock. No murder weapon was ever recovered. About 1:09 a.m., surveillance video shows Hernandez, Wallace, and Ortiz leave Hernandez's home in a silver Nissan Altima. Police think Wallace was driving. 1:22 to 2:32 a.m., Lloyd receives 5 phone calls from a number later traced to a cell phone used by Wallace. About 2 a.m., on their way to pick up Lloyd, Hernandez, Wallace, and Ortiz stop at the Blue Hill Express service station on Route 138 in Canton, Massachusetts. Hernandez purchases Bubblicious Blue Cotton Candy Bubble Gum. This kind of gum with Hernandez's DNA is later found in the Altima, along with a .45 caliber shell casing, the same caliber used to